accepted the gift.
Wait a minute, he's taking another card out for Beckham. It's a red card.
I'm in the stand with the fans. I go with my boy, my best friend and his boy.
He gets the ball and he's gone and kicked it.
England need three consecutive penalties in the shootout. It's poor Bukayo Saka who misses the crucial one. Phil Foden and into the back of the net. And Harry Kane pulling away. England in front.
Is he looking forward to all the football?
Hello and welcome to Pro Revolution Soccer, and welcome, I suppose, to the morning after the night before. As we're recording this, the fallout from England's defeat to Spain in the final of the European Championships is still going on, but luckily I have a very dear friend and comrade with me to coach me through it. Clapton community legend, goal poacher extraordinaire, art critic, and my fellow host of Pro Revo, Juliet Jakes. Hello, Juliet. How are you feeling after last night?
I did wake up very hungover and depressed after watching the final and drinking a lot of mojitos around a friend's house.
Oh, hark at you.
Well, quite. Yeah, no, I'm not going to claim to be working class, unlike some other football fans from my bit of East Surrey.
It's not about mojitos. It's about your relationship to production.
this seems like an elaborate coping mechanism for what we saw unfold last night, which, to be honest, was just no hard feelings, no regrets. England, I think, were just beaten by the outstanding team in the tournament and the better side on the night. Cole Palmer's equaliser, of course, was a really, really kind of magical moment.
The touch back from Bellingham was just...
Yeah, the touch from Bellingham, and the finish was golden. You know, it's a beautiful, beautiful move, and I think made the overall performance, and particularly the second half performance, look a lot better than it was. Spain winning the tournament was utterly deserved, I think. I've got no qualms about it whatsoever. How about you?
Yeah, I mean, you wanted to talk about the grovelling apologies to Southgate after the semi-final, and I'll add a conversational adjunct to that, I think.
That's exactly what they were, grovelling apologies to Southgate, and, you know, newspaper headlines along the lines of, "Arise, Sir Gareth." And I just kind of thought, look, once again, you know, he's done a decent job of making sure England beat the teams they should beat, which, you know, he took over after they'd just gone out of Euro 2016 to Iceland. So, you know, that's not nothing. But, you know, England did have a rather fortuitous path to the final, and they made very heavy weather of that. My feeling was that Southgate hadn't done anything like magnificently intelligent with the team. My feeling was it sort of progressed largely thanks to inspired moments from very good to world-class players, Bellingham and Saka in particular, and obviously Ollie Watkins, really inspired goal in the semi-final after a somewhat dubious VAR penalty.
Your view on this, I know, is that it was a bit of a rebuke to the tactics of obsessives that England got as far as they did without Southgate actually doing anything too clever. I disagree slightly. Scope for a bit of productive difference here. but because I think what ultimately proved to be Southgate's undoing was his lack of tactical imagination, which almost, I think, seems to be a matter of principle sometimes. And that habit that we discussed in an earlier episode of pragmatism lapsing actually into dogmatism due to the erroneous, I think, now sense that to be pragmatic is to be negative. It's the same in politics. You know, to be truly pragmatic now would be to, for example, actually take the necessarily radical action on climate, whereas our political and media classes believe that pragmatism means watching the global south burn. And in the case of the England football team, with its sort of abundance of exciting attacking players and relative paucity now of sort of stolid destroyers of England teams of old, I think it would arguably have been more pragmatic to try and swamp Spain's double pivot and scare the living daylights out of their fullbacks so that they'd stay back a bit by having players run in behind. But instead, the focus ended up being on basically locking both sides because we were terrified of those lovely wingers of theirs. However, I do think that Southgate's legacy, if he does, you know, if he does decide now to step down, you know, there'll be more to it than that. I mean, we rather cheekily likened dear old Gareth to David Cameron in an earlier episode, because as Juliet said, both of them detoxified conservative institutions. But I think in Southgate's case, having done so is a genuinely good thing. Because I see the national team as not really a national team at all, to be honest. It's just a team like any other that a bunch of people happen to support. And therefore, over time, through all the victories and defeats, you build up a bank of collective memories. And in that sense, it's pretty much the same as a club team. I won't ever feel as close to it as I do to my club team because it's not a pillar of my social life in the same way that my club team is. And because it's not local to me, but it's more, although it is to you, isn't it? But it's also more culturally significant than my club team in that it's a pole of greater attraction. It dominates the news cycle in a way that most club teams never could. And as such, anyone who makes it more inclusive is all right by me. I think it's worth saying here that a lot of people like us didn't really care about England for a long, long time. And personally, I found the sort of cliqueiness and individualism of the players from about 2006 onwards intolerable, really, to a point where I didn't really care whether they won or lost. But Southgate creating an environment in which players who aren't hatchet-faced, white, petty, bourgeois little Englanders like John Terry can feel comfortable has made a lot more fans feel comfortable in cheering the team on. And I think that's a real achievement. I mean, as a communist, nation states aren't really my jar of gherkins, to be honest. But I do like the idea of people coming together. And I don't think everyone who goes to the pub to cheer England on is coalescing around a nation state. So I think it's good and nice, albeit within certain limitations. So thank you, Gareth.
Yeah, and also, I mean, I should say, sort of lowering the bar somewhat here, but England's defeat does at least spare us the homecoming party with Keir Starmer and David Baddiel at number 10. So, you know, every cloud, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, I mean, but do you know what? It's not the England of Keir Starmer and David Baddiel, you know. It's the Labour Party of Keir Starmer and David Baddiel that are running the country. But that England team, you know, and the comparisons, the really snide kind of attempts to claim Southgate as, you know, as a sort of an analogue to Starmer are really off the mark in my view, because they couldn't be more different. You know, Starmer has turned the Labour Party into a very narrow clique of people with very peculiar opinions about pretty much everything. I mean, if you go to your local Wetherspoons, you know, you're not going to hear somebody say to me, you know what, Dave, you know what this country needs? It needs a large but heavily marketised state and an expansionist liberal interventionist foreign policy. That is the politics of the Labour right. And you're not, you know, it's not the politics of very many people in this country. Whereas if you look at that England team, Southgate's attitude to stuff like Black Lives Matter, the inclusivity, it's the polar opposite of this iteration of the Labour Party, frankly, where, you know, people of colour, anti-Zionist Jews and various other people have been made to feel very, very unwelcome, if not just kicked out of the party.
Trans people as well, let's not forget us. So it'll be interesting to see, I guess, if Southgate does stand down, you know, if there's a sort of shift in the zeitgeist somehow, and if the manager of the England team ends up occupying maybe a slightly different sort of political and social role, or having it maybe kind of forced upon them in the way that the Southgate did. But I guess time will tell about that.
He's never comfortable with it, was he? But
and understandably,
yeah,
you know.
it's not his job. But he did it anyway, and I think I will always sort of admire him to some extent.
So just a little bit more reflection on the tournament. Last time round, we drew a few parallels between Southgate and the France manager Didier Deschamps. France, of course, you know, looks incredibly disjointed, disappointing throughout the tournament. Their undoubted highlight was taking the lead against Spain in the semi-final. And if Mbappe had scored the chance he made for himself shortly after, then they might well have squeezed Spain out and made the final. I think they actually probably gave Spain a better game than England did on the whole. But Spain, yes, I think absolutely have been the best team in the tournament. Do you think they look like a force for the future, Tom? You know, they sort of led the way with a sort of quite systematised way of playing football, what the Barcelona marketing department successfully managed to get everyone calling tiki-taka. Do they point a way out of that? I mean, what's your sort of thoughts about this Spain team and the sort of evolution of football at a club and international level?
I would argue that the way that they are now playing is still heavily systematised. They're just playing less like a kind of typical or maybe stereotypical La Liga team and more like a Bundesliga team with intense pressing, quick transitions and more reliance on top line runs. Although that, you know, that was still a feature of some of the better La Liga teams during their sort of tiki-taka In terms of them being a force for the future, absolutely. And they absolutely should be. And England still, I think, lags a long way behind Spain in one, I think, very crucial respect, which is the number of coaches active in Spanish football at grassroots level and the relative ease with which you can qualify as a coach in Spain. You know, I for listeners who don't realise, I'm a UEFA B qualified coach, but it cost me an arm and a leg to get to that point. For this coming season, I have been, to sort of paraphrase Michael Corleone, dragged back into to coaching because I'm going to be coaching a kids team from next season, which I am looking forward to. It's just it's very time consuming, and part of the reason that I've ended up doing that is that there are so few qualified coaches out there because it's really expensive. I mean, this actually led to perhaps, you know, if we do more of these, I'll tell the story of how I ended up doing my not my UEFA B but my level 2 through the army. So you can imagine what they made of me, a socialist, anti-imperialist, with all these squaddies. But yeah, let's save that one for another time. But yeah, like Spanish football has the infrastructure, and although England has caught up, English football and Britain in general's habit of funneling resources towards a tiny elite is, I think, still holding English football back.
Yeah, fair enough. I can't disagree with any of that. I mean, let's just sort of round out the tournament then with a reflection on the overall quality of it. My feeling is that it was maybe less entertaining and enjoyable a tournament than Euro 2020 or 21. Probably the overall standard of play, I think, was better than Euro 2016, with a better, much better winning team, but fewer kind of interesting shocks and surprises than that tournament. And I mean, I've said all the way through, I think there are too many teams. That's something we're going to come on to in a bit. And I strongly dislike VAR and the way it's been used through this tournament. And there's also been much talk about the players just being exhausted, lots of players barely having a break, really, since football restarted after the COVID lockdown in 2020. So I don't know what your feelings about this, Tom. Do you think this is too negative or pessimistic?
I think it's kind of mirroring club football a little bit, in that the sort of the elite teams are finding it easier to offset the risk of shocks. I think the preponderance in club football of pressing now has perhaps actually jumped the shark a little bit and has led to international teams having worked out that actually it's much easier to organise a press than it is to organise a sort of an in possession part of your game model. So we saw a lot of pressing in that tournament, and as a result of all the pressing, we also saw the return of the big unit, the return of the big number nine,
Nicholas Fulkrug, as he was known.
Yeah. Well, a case in point, but by no means the only example. In fact, you know, some teams were using two big lads up front. The reason for doing this is that a lot of the teams, you know, Austria being the sort of like classic example, but also Spain, pressed really, really well, and teams were finding it difficult to play through the lines of pressure created by those presses, and instead we're just deciding to go over the top of it. And I think there's always been a sense that it's certainly in this country, and we're going to get onto this actually, in the sort of the chunky bit of the episode. There's always been a sense in this country that makes for more entertaining football, that more direct football makes for entertaining football. And I think actually this tournament showed that it doesn't always.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, there have been a baffling development of people I've seen on Twitter talking about football being more expressive and exciting 20 years ago, which was the time of Jose Mourinho winning the European Cup and Greece under Otto Rehhagel 1-0-ing their way to winning the European Championship. So that's been bizarre to me, quite frankly.
Yeah, I think there's a bit of magical thinking going on there. You know, that was what Jonathan Wilson called the athletes with footballs era as well, where you know, instead of having these little technicians in the middle of the pitch, like, you know, you now have Rodri and Ruiz in the Spanish team, but even in England's team, eventually in this tournament, we saw Kobbie Mainoo, who is, you know, this really excellent technician who plays really nicely on the half turn, which is not something that English midfielders have been noted for over the years. Instead of players like that, you had you know, 6'4" guys who could run a lot and couldn't necessarily play football very well. I think, you know, they tended to be sort of like, I think they were supposed to be in the image of Patrick Vieira, who was kind of seen as the perfect midfielder at that point. And he kind of was, but it wasn't just his athleticism. It was his intelligence and the his reading of the game and the fact that he was a really good technical player as well.
Well, all right. Well, that wraps up Euro 2024. So commiserations to England, congratulations to Spain. And I'm looking forward to another season of club football. I actually went to my first game of the 24-25 season on Saturday, which was a friendly between Cray Wanderers, the oldest club in London, and Sheffield, the oldest club in the world, which was won 4-0 by Sheffield at the new Cray Wanderers ground in southeast London. So domestic football is back and I'm very excited. European football is also back if you were following the very early preliminary rounds of the Europa League and the Conference League. And you may have seen the likes of Carnarvon Town and Crusaders of Northern Ireland battle out against teams like Olimpia Ljubljana and Dečić of... Actually, I can't even remember where Dečić are from, but I'm sure they're great. And so that brings us on to our topic, which is the sort of tandem evolution of European football competition and what has become the European Union and the idea of Europe, which feels like a nice way to round out this this mini series off the back of the European Championship. So just to start with a little bit of distant history, because Tom, you know, I love that. So, you know, obviously first international football is played in 1872 between England and Scotland, and the home international championship becomes the first ever kind of regular international tournament when it's launched in 1883. So FIFA is formed in 1904 to represent 8 European nations, not including the teams in the British Isles, but 8 Western European nations, including Switzerland, the Netherlands, France, and others. And so Britain does join FIFA in time, the British nations, but they all refuse to play in the World Cup despite being invited in 1930. This is partly because of this sort of much discussed British sense of superiority about them being the inventors of football, and why should they sort of sully themselves by having to prove their superiority by, you know, actually playing other countries in competitive football. But it's also notable that Great Britain have a team in the Olympic Games. And it's worth sort of remembering that the World Cup doesn't really properly supersede the Olympic Games football tournament in prestige until after the Second World War. Before that, they're much closer in sort of status. Famously, England don't lose to an overseas team until they play Hungary at Wembley in 1953. They don't lose at home, that is. They play in the 1950 World Cup and they lose 1-0 to the USA. But this is seen as a bit of an aberration. In fact, famously, some newspapers reported the score as 10-1 to England because they assumed it was an error that the USA had won 1-0. And that doesn't shatter the illusion. And even after they lose 6-3 at home to Hungary in 1953, they kind of say, all right, well, we'll have a rematch in Hungary, which Hungary wins 7-1. This is sort of seen as largely a driver for a complete revolution in English football that culminates in them winning the World Cup in 1966. But I think it has an interesting place in the sort of creation of European-wide football as well.
So obviously, like, one of the drivers of the idea of Europe, I suppose, was that people were sick of war. But actually, those European conflicts inadvertently contributed to a distinction between English and European football, or at least attitudes to what are seen as essential characteristics of English football and European football that endure to this day, as we've just discussed, actually. But also to the great irony that the more possession-based European playing models were inspired by this misfit Englishman called Jimmy Hogan. He was born in Burnley in a staunchly Roman Catholic family. He toyed with the idea of becoming a priest. His dad wanted him to be an accountant. But he went on to be one of the most influential coaches in the history of football. And as the coach of that great Hungary side, Gustav Sebez, said, "We played football as Jimmy Hogan taught us." He became friends with Hugo Meisel and was sort of invited over to the continent, to Austria, to help coach the Austrian team. It didn't sort of initially go very well. The Austrian players found him difficult to understand, and they sort of also felt a bit kind of patronised by him. They felt that he was focusing a bit too much on the basics, but they eventually grew to sort of really like him. But unfortunately, the onset of the probability of the First World War rather ruined things. And Hogan approached the British consul and asked whether it would be a good idea to take his family back to Britain, but was told that there was no imminent danger. And then within 2 days, war had been declared, and he got arrested as a foreign national, and he got stuck in Austria, basically. I think the Americans managed to get his wife and children back to Britain, and Jimmy got released the day before he was due to be sent to an internment camp in Germany. When he got back to Britain, he was rather bizarrely, in my view, seen as a traitor. He found it difficult to find work because he'd been working in Austria. He believed that he was due £200 from the FA, and was treated with complete contempt by the FA, and was told rather pertly that the fund was for people who had fought. And Hogan pointed out that, you know, he'd been basically a POW for 4 years, so he hadn't really had much chance to sign up. And their response, the FA's response, was to give him 3 pairs of socks, sneering that the boys at the front were very glad of those. And Hogan was furious. He never forgave the FA, and he focused instead on continuing his sort of adventures through European football. So he was initially greeted with suspicion, and he didn't speak German very well. So when he was in Germany working as a coach, the German FA asked him to prove himself by delivering a lecture in German, which didn't go entirely well at first anyway. He ended up calling for a 10-minute break, and then reappeared in his Bolton Wanderers kit, removed his boots and his socks, told the German audience that that three-quarters of German players couldn't kick a ball properly, and then absolutely battered a shot barefoot into a wooden panel that was 15 yards away. And then when the ball bounced back to him, he explained to the bemused audience the value of being two-footed, and smashed it back again with his left foot and broke the panel and shattered into several million pieces. And but at this point, the German football, the whole of German football basically went, Herr Jimmy Hogan, we owe you an apology if we were unaware of your game. And he ended up, when he died, Hans Passlack, the secretary of the German Football Federation at the time, wrote to Jimmy Hogan's son Frank saying that Hogan was the founder of modern football in Germany. So, yeah, a bit of a nutter, I would suspect, but also a visionary and a prophet.
Well, the history of early football, you know, is to some extent the story of some of these visionaries, including Jimmy Hogan, who also has a plaque for him at Turf Moor in Burnley now. So, you know, there is some appreciation in his home country. I mean, you mentioned Hugo Meisel there and Hogan's association with him. And Meisel is a huge player in the establishment of Central European football as the sort of cradle of international club competition. So again, we talked about the First World War. There had been a Challenge Cup founded in the Austro-Hungarian Empire in 1897, which is the first international club competition, as far as I can tell, with teams from Vienna and Budapest and Prague. I mean, I guess it's not an international club competition because it was one nation at the time, but, you know. But professional football comes quite early to the former Habsburg Empire. It comes in the 1920s. So before France or the Netherlands or Scandinavia, for example, or I think Germany, and teams are struggling to meet the costs. English clubs are touring in Austria, Hungary, Czechoslovakia, and bringing in these big crowds. So Hugo Meisel, who at the time is president of one of the leading clubs, FK Austria, suggests an international club competition. So the Mitropa Cup is launched in 1927 with teams from Italy, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, Austria, and later Yugoslavia, Romania and Switzerland. And it's quite similar to what comes next. It's two-legged format, it's very popular, and it's broadcast by radio across Central Europe. And indeed, a customs union between Italy, Hungary and Austria was introduced at the same time. The idea for a national European competition is also mooted. And in this respect, Europe is some way behind South America, where the Copa America is launched as early as 1916. This international competition doesn't come to pass, and the Metropa Cup is suspended towards the end of the 1930-1940 edition due to the outbreak of the Second World War, and it's not officially held again until 1955, which is the year that the European Cup is launched. The sort of mid-1950s is really crucial. I've already talked about Hungary beating England 6-3 and 7-1, who were coached by a man you've already mentioned, Tom Gustav Szebes, following in the footsteps of Jimmy Hogan. We've already talked about the establishment of FIFA as well and the early European dominance of it. There is indeed much bitterness in the 1930s because the idea is that the World Cup is going to alternate between Europe and South America. The first tournament is held in Uruguay in 1930, partly because Uruguay have won the two Olympic tournaments in 1924 and 1928. And then the second one is held in Italy, which we discussed in our episode on football and the far right. The expectation was that the third tournament would be hosted in South America, either in Argentina or Brazil. It's given to France, partly because there's a big French presence in FIFA, and this causes much upset in South America, and it leads to Argentina and Uruguay boycotting the competition, which is then won again by Italy beating Hungary in the final. So by 1952, the numerical majority that Europe has enjoyed within FIFA has more or less gone, with the sort of joining of more countries from Asia. And the sort of de facto control is going to be lost. And of course, there are anxieties about anti-colonial and independence movements, which are likely to weaken the European stranglehold over FIFA further. So despite the Iron Curtain, football administrators from East and Western Europe meet at a conference in Bern in June 1954 around the World Cup that's being held in Switzerland, and UEFA is founded, so sort of Union of European Football Associations. And there's a parallel here to the Schuman Declaration of 1950, when the French foreign minister announces an intention for France and West Germany to pool their coal and steel production with the aim of making war in between them inconceivable. And Henri Delaunay, the president of the French Football Association, is much inspired by this, and he writes an essay entitled, Is It Possible to Build a Footballing Europe? And again, you know, this very French idea that underpins the modern Olympic Games and the World Cup, both of which are French inventions, of, you know, sport as a sort of healthy substitute for war as a means of competition between nations. So we're back talking about the great Hungarian team of the mid-1950s again. They are built around the team in Budapest, Honved, for whom the bulk of that Hungarian team that beat England so comprehensively in those two games in 1953 are playing. The best club side in England at this time, just about shading it over Matt Busby's Manchester United, are Wolverhampton Wanderers, managed by Stan Cullis. And in December 1954... partly as a means of showcasing the new floodlight technology that is being introduced to major football grounds across Europe, as well as the increasing interest in broadcasting football, Wolves organise a friendly at their Molineux ground against Honved. And Honved go 2-0 up after 10 minutes. And it seems like we're going to get another demonstration of the just complete superiority of Hungarian football over English and a lot of the rest of the continent. At halftime, Stan Cullis waters the pitch and basically turns it into a quagmire to make it much harder for the Hungarians to play. And sure enough, Wolves come back to win 3-2. And the English press, with their typical sort of humility and open-mindedness, declare Wolves the champions of the world and say that English football is still the best in the world. This particularly annoys the editor of L'Équipe, who's another very interesting character in our story. He's a man called Gabriel Hanno, who had played for France in either side of the First World War and had advocated for a professional championship in France in 1932. And, you know, partly just agitated by the English arrogance in the wake of this somewhat dubiously won friendly, says that we should introduce a European Cup where the champions play each other home and away before a neutral final. Hannah also creates the Ballon d'Or, by the way, around about the same time. And the first winner is an Englishman, Stanley Matthews. So anyway, Hanno's idea for a European Cup is a popular one. So the first final is played in Paris in June 1956, in which Real Madrid beat the French champion Stade de Rome 4-3. The games are going to be played on weeknights, thanks to the advent of floodlights. You probably won't be surprised to hear that the English are reluctant to play at first. They don't enter the first competition. And when they do eventually enter, one or two years in, Manchester United famously lose the bulk of their great young team in the Munich air crash on the way back from a match against Red Star Belgrade in February 1958. So it's quite a fateful thing for the English clubs to play. The initial power in the tournament lies with Spain, Portugal and Italy. In the first 10 years, you get Eintracht Frankfurt from Germany making the final in 1960. But it's really FK Partizan of Belgrade making the final in 1966 that starts to shift, sort of starts to indicate a bit of a power shift. And then over the next sort of the rest of the 60s and the 70s, you get Celtic winning, Feyenoord and Ajax win four European Cups between them, Manchester United win, Bayern Munich wins three in a row, and then there's a period of English dominance with Liverpool, Nottingham Forest, Aston Villa all winning the tournament between 1967 and 1982. So there's mass televising of these games and the formation of extra European club competitions at this time. So you get the European Cup Winners' Cup in, I think, 1960-61, and the Intercities Fairs Cup, which is slightly more informal at the end of the 50s into the 1960s. And then UEFA kind of take that tournament on in 1971, and it becomes the UEFA Cup. Round about the same time, of course, you get the Treaty of Rome signed in March 1957, less than a year after the first European Cup final. And this basically sets up the Parliament, the Central Commission and the Court and everything about the EU as we sort of know it today, the geographical expansion, the creation of the European Commission, the common market, the abolition of trade barriers and the shared currency all spring from here. European integration is a means of securing continued dominance in Africa as much as anything. And indeed, in 1987, Morocco applied to join the European Union and basically get laughed out of the room. There are sort of domestic political calculations at play here. There's a lot of concerns about the strength of the left and the communist parties after World War II, which is largely bought off by the advent of social democracy, of course, until the mid-1970s crisis, the collapse of the Bretton Woods Agreement, and big defeats for organised labour across the continent and the rise of neoliberalism in the UK in particular.
I think this is key. You know, between about 1957 and 1979, British governments pursued loosely social democratic policies. And then, you know, in 1979, when Britain voted quite enthusiastically to stay in the EEC, that was probably also the peak of social democracy. But because of the left's failure to push on towards real socialism, the crisis of profitability and the use of neoliberalism as the sell for that crisis saw social democracy going to retreat. And without a real alternative to Thatcherism from the left, we ended up with the crisis of 2007 to 2009, the global financial crisis. Seeing that combination of metropolitan social liberalism and freewheeling finance-based capitalism come unstuck. And everything since then really has just been a response to that without any clear plan for what should come next. And, you know, the lesson of Britain, really, you know, we're talking about Europe, but the lesson of Britain is that, you know, the long expected crisis that everyone thinks will sort of act as a moment of reset, it never really arrives, because the decline is usually bigger and more locked in structurally than sort of temporary moments of crisis signal. And as long as things go well enough for the people who matter, who are content to use their earlier successes, colonial successes mostly, and also their respected institutions for basically rent seeking, as long as there are plenty of distractions for those who don't matter, i.e. racism, it will continue to limp along. But also, you know, what does the following remind you of? I think, you know, there were six, were they, like, original founding states which drew together in the 1950s to the succession of treaties that created today's EU. You know, and they show two characteristics. The first is essentially closed and undemocratic nature of the union. You know, what Perry Anderson writes is behind closed doors, in deliberations of which no minutes are kept, the issue in announcements to the world under the seal of consensus. I mean, that's, you know, that's almost sort of Perry kind of parodying himself there. That's just how he writes. But then the second related characteristic is what Perry calls the coup. Every great turn in its development, actions that had no license in the European treaties and rules promoted the advance of European integration. And that began with judicial rulings by the European Court of Justice in 1963 and 64 that established the primacy of European over national law. So, like, that means power getting further away from people and further away from democratic oversight, as Anderson observes, without any warrant in the Treaty of Rome. And it's that this sort of passivity of the European public, encouraged by the structures of the EU, you know, that allows decision making between elites. And then, you know, if you sort of look back at Grexit, remember that, you know, the brutality with which those elites put down popular opposition. To me, this all sounds, this kind of, you know, almost post-political stuff and this triumph over the working class in the 20th and 21st centuries, that to me sounds almost exactly like how David Goldblatt told us that FIFA came to be the way it currently is. Power grabs, coups, and the whiff of corruption at almost every turn.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's true of UEFA as well as FIFA, which we'll come on to a bit more now. You know, we're sort of getting towards the kind of neoliberal era as we're talking about. So the sort of interesting thing that Eastern European teams dominate the Olympic football tournament after the war, and it's really become a pale shadow of the World Cup by this point. And partly to compensate for this, I think, the European Championship is launched in 1960. And the idea is it would be held every 4 years, sort of between the World Cups. And, you know, this was proposed by Henri Delaunay as early as 1927, but doesn't begin until 1958. The initial tournaments have this long qualifying, and there's only four teams playing in the actual finals. The Soviet Union win in 1960, Italy, the Netherlands, West Germany and England don't enter. And there are still some political issues in 1964. Spain are due to be hosting, obviously still under Franco. The Soviet Union do go and Spain beat them in the final. Greece don't enter the tournament after they're drawn against Albania, who they're technically still at war with. It's only expanded to eight teams in 1980, with the host qualifying automatically, and this remains the case until 1992, which is another tournament in which international politics comes to bear very heavily, when the Commonwealth of Independent States play in their only international tournament after the breakup of the Soviet Union in 1991, and Yugoslavia are famously replaced by Denmark about 10 days before the tournament's due to kick off. Yugoslavia get as far as actually naming a squad for the tournament before sanctions are placed on them due to the civil war, and Denmark replaced them, of course, very famously win the tournament. So you have this sort of sense of kind of like greater European integration after the collapse of the Soviet Union. By this point, you know, you've had the death of Stalin in 1953 and the denunciation in 1956, independence being won by various African countries between the 1950s and the 1980s, the resolution of the Years of Lead in Italy by the 1980s. The collapse of Portuguese and Spanish fascism in the mid-1970s, the fall of the Berlin Wall and the end of the Iron Curtain in 1989, and yeah, the breakup of the Soviet Union Yugoslavia in 1991. So that's the end of dictatorship, like pretty much everywhere in Europe, barring Belarus, famously.
And worth saying here that you don't have to be a massive tanky or apologist for Stalinism to see that the fall of the Soviet Union was a disaster for the various lefts and workers' movements in Western Europe, because without actually existing state socialism to discipline the impulses of capital, capital has just really done as it pleases.
Absolutely, and that's incredibly true in European football, particularly European club football, since the end of the 1980s. So on a previous episode about the Premier League, we talked about the Heysel disaster in 1985, English clubs being banned from Europe for 5 years, there being trouble at the 1988 European Championships, and English clubs being readmitted in 1990. So it's really 1990 to about 1993 is the point where you get this complete political and football kind of reintegration of the whole continent of Europe, like for better or for worse. And it's also around about this time you get the reformatting of the European Cup into the Champions League. Like, this was an idea that had been raised in 1986 when various Western European countries were affronted by Steaua Bucharest becoming the first Eastern European team to win the European Cup. And Juventus against Real Madrid early in the 1986-7 edition, one of them being knocked out very early on, raises the idea of a move away from this unseeded, two-legged, straight knockout tournament to a new structure that's more likely to guarantee the supremacy of the bigger clubs. And I'm sure nobody would be surprised to hear that the AC Milan owner Silvio Berlusconi was a big supporter of this. So the last tournament without a league format is in 1991, and it's won by Red Star Belgrade, that great team that they put together again just before the war in Yugoslavia broke it up. So a league stage is introduced in the 1991-92 tournament, and the Champions League name in 92-93, same season, of course, as the Premier League. And around about the same time, of course, the European Union, as we now know it, is established by the Maastricht Treaty in 1992. European Parliament gets kind of properly consecrated. And there's this real sense of this kind of democratic deficit. And I've heard it sort of talked about. I think Kostas Lapavitsis talks about it in his book, The Left Case Against the EU. You are far more likely to get a meeting with the European Parliament if you're lobbying for a business and if you're working for a trade union. Single currency is introduced 2002, and then there's a significant influx of new members to the European Union 2004, big expansion, and again in 2007 and 2013. And the European Union, you know, really aims to insulate certain things like human rights from the tyranny of the majority, but it's been pretty ineffectual in many of those cases. For example, with Hungary, just like rescinding gender recognition from its trans population in, I think, 2020, to little kind of meaningful opposition from the European Union. But it's also pointed out that, you know, this is the first time that things like banking and budget setting have been really insulated from democratic control in this way. The European Union's competition directorate is very like ultra-free market. Becomes interested in football, it becomes interested in television rights, monopolies with broadcasters, ticket agents, etc. The European Commission and UEFA had a gentleman's agreement over restrictions on foreign players in the 1980s, which was seen as an infringement to free movement of labour in the various European treaties up to that point. There's a particular problem for English clubs, actually. There's a slight rule change where you can have, I think, three foreign players and two assimilated ones, because obviously English football has, for over a century, relied on Scottish, Welsh and Irish players who are not considered foreign in the way that players from outside of Great Britain and Ireland have been, and have been banned until 1978, when the ban is lifted. So you get the Bosman ruling in 1995 as well, when the Belgian footballer Jean-Marc Bosman sues his club in Belgium to get free movement after his contract expires. And in the court case that does this, you also get the abolition of the three foreigners rule. So players move internationally far more often without transfer fees. My favourite example of this in England is with Walsall, who introduced a policy of not paying for players, and so they don't pay a transfer fee for quite a long time, and sign a lot of players from continental Europe. My favourite being Jean-Jacques Idaly, who was the person whose garden was dug up and the money found after the Marseille match-fixing scandal of 1993.
Did you say Walsall or Warsaw?
Walsall, yeah.
Walsall, as in the West Midlands.
Near Birmingham, yeah.
Was this when Ray Graydon was the manager?
I think so, yeah.
He was he managed me.
Oh, right. OK, yeah. Well, you have a direct link then to the Marseille match-fixing scandal of 1993. He also, I've got some older friends who have never forgiven him for scoring the only goal of the 1975 League Cup final for Aston Villa against Norwich City. But anyway, I'm sure he talks about it a lot as well. But I think it's Jan Sorensen, actually, who signs these guys in particular. But yeah, Idaly is... his name sticks out like a sore thumb in the otherwise stellar collection of names in that Marseille team that win the Champions League. And it's because he's the mule, basically.
Right.
He gets banned from football for 3 years. And when he comes back, he ends up playing for Walsall as punishment, and is probably nicknamed Idle Git by the Walsall faithful, who are not particularly impressed with his work rate. But, you know, you also get at the same time the... This leads to a lot of Eastern European players moving abroad, often while they're very, very young, and getting lost in Western clubs' kind of youth setups or, you know, increasingly kind of bloated squads. And this has a really quite detrimental effect on national teams in Eastern Europe, who I think by and large do become less competitive, both in international and in club competitions across Europe. One exception to this is, of course, the Czech Republic team that make the final of Euro 96. In England, after the tournament doubles in size, you get Russia and Croatia competing in that tournament. And, you know, in 2000, you get the first co-hosted tournament between the Netherlands and Belgium. There's changes in the Champions League as well. UEFA introduced their logo in 1996, which is based to some extent on the EU flag. It's a lot of stars and a starred match ball. They also introduce an anthem similar to the EU's use of Ode to Joy, which is Tony Britton's adaptation of Georg Friedrich Handel's Zadok the Priest. It's commissioned in 1991. And you may remember Manchester City being fined because their fans booed it a few years ago. They also bring in much stricter control over the marketing, advertising, television deals. And by 2000, you get the Champions League shown live in 200 countries. So really, you're sort of what you're starting to get is the Champions League starting to obliterate a lot of other club competitions, or if not obliterate, then like drastically weaken them and make them a lot less interesting.
The FA Cup being a really good example.
The FA Cup being a great example. I'll come on to that in a minute. I think one of the first things is South American club competition, because South American clubs... You know, there's always been a flow of talent from South America to Europe. But, you know, for example, like Pelé and Garrincha don't play in Europe, the two stars of Brazilian football of the 1960s. And it's really from the sort of, I'd say, sort of 70s or 80s onwards that it becomes the case that, you know, no high-profile South American player is going to not play in Europe. It's sort of seen as like fundamentally unserious if they don't do that. There's pressure on UEFA to expand the Champions League in the mid-90s. So they start letting in second-place teams from, I think, 1995 onwards, maybe 96. And this is all sort of soon expanded to third and fourth-place clubs from the bigger leagues that are sort of done by a kind of coefficient system that basically guarantees that the most successful leagues will continue to get the most clubs in the competition. So the European Cup Winners' Cup is abolished in 1999 because once you're letting in second place teams into the Champions League, you can't let the cup runners up necessarily into a Cup Winners' Cup anymore because they both might qualify for a Champions League. And so the Cup Winners' Cup would become something of a farce. I think that was always the weirdest and most interesting of the European Cup club competitions in a way. But of course, this also has the effect of drastically devaluing domestic cup competitions as well. And indeed, in 1999 to 2000, Manchester United skipped the FA Cup entirely to play in a new World Club Cup that has been introduced.
With Brian Clough saying, "I hope they all get bloody diarrhea."
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, we've quoted Brian Clough a lot on this show, and I think that may be his greatest line yet. And the Europa League, with its sort of bloated format and frankly baffling qualifying criteria, supersedes the UEFA Cup in 2009. And the Conference League is established in 2022, which is like the Europa League, but for weaker teams. The domestic leagues, as a result, become less competitive because the huge prize money around the European competitions gets concentrated around clubs that sort of continually qualify for the Champions League. And you get this kind of negative feedback loop. And of course, bigger clubs get taken over by oligarchs in a way that we've talked about with David Goldblatt. And you get this sort of sense of like club football and the Champions League sort of superseding international football as well. One answer to this is to expand the European Championship. So in 2007, Scotland and Ireland proposed expanding it further, in part due to the large number of countries in Europe, including Israel and Kazakhstan. And only three of the 54 UEFA members vote against. You know, there's kind of structural problem here. Like almost everyone wants this kind of growth for themselves, have a better chance of being a part of it. But I think it's bad for the integrity of these tournaments. And then you get, you know, Euro 2020, which is perhaps a sign that the tournament is so large that it's hard to host it in anywhere other than the biggest European countries. So this is scheduled to be host all across Europe with venues including Azerbaijan, and Budapest, where you know, you see a lot of like far right Hungarian supporters that we've also talked about before, with the semi-finals and the finals at Wembley, and indeed Brussels is removed as a host in 2017 because their much vaunted Euro stadium is delayed and the project is eventually cancelled, and of course the tournament is delayed by a year due to the COVID pandemic. So we've talked about the defeat of the European Super League concept and the expansion of the European Champions League, with the sort of coefficient principle expanded to make it even harder for the bigger clubs to miss out on the competition. And it's worth pointing out at this point that no team from outside England, France, Spain, Italy and Germany has even reached the final since Porto won in 2004. They themselves were the first team from outside those five to reach the final since Ajax in 1996, and no French team has won the final, and the only one to reach the final since Monaco in 2004 were the Qatari-backed PSG Paris Saint-Germain in 2020. And there was a sort of interesting stat that no team had retained the European Cup, that no team had retained the Champions League, until 2014, when Real Madrid. 2015 actually, Real Madrid won their second in a row, and Real Madrid have since won 6 of the last 11. Champions Leagues.
Despite often not being the best team in Spain, it's their record in the Champions League is absolutely insane.
Yeah, I mean, Zinedine Zidane and Carlo Ancelotti as coaches, you know, clearly really know their way around that competition. But, you know, around about the same time, you have sort of changes to the EU again, the Greek crisis in 2015, and the sense of the European Union kind of arrogating more economic power to itself and putting them beyond democratic control. You get obviously Brexit during this time and constant fears of the European Parliament being dominated by the far right, and increased anxieties about migration. And they're largely sort of shared European anxieties about migration from Asia and Africa, but they're enacted at a sort of national rather than European wide level.
So far,
exactly. And, you know, lots of far right movements building a base on opposition to European migration policies, and the French and Dutch rejection of the EU constitutional treaty in 2005, owing something to this as well. So I don't really know what to kind of conclude here, other than, you know, you have a sort of increasing concentration of power, lack of democracy and distancing from the public in both, you know, UEFA and the European Union, an increased sort of, you know, combination of sort of big business and sort of oligarchs and capitalistic interests being at odds with the public, who, you know, sort of lurch towards this sort of nationalistic, perhaps, opposition. None of which sort of makes me feel sort of particularly good about the place of left resistance within that. Maybe there's some little glimmers of hope in the French electoral result from a week or two ago. But, you know, that's sort of this complex picture that I really wanted to paint for our listeners, a sort of tandem evolution of UEFA and the European Union and the sort of, you know, political, economic, social and, I don't know, sporting consequences of those sort of twin developments, cultural consequences.
Yeah, well, and therefore cultural, because, you know, I think, you know, you and I would agree that football is part of culture. I mean, I think that was a really important thing to have addressed. I thought you did it brilliantly there. I wonder, like, I think European football might actually have been slightly ahead of Europe as a political project at times. But I wonder if EU nationalism deepens, and as Europe sort of plunges deeper into war and state budgets for war and sanctions and espionage and subterfuge sort of increase, I wonder if football might sort of find itself at loggerheads with Fortress Europe as a project, because of course football relies so heavily and the top clubs rely so heavily on being able to sort of cherry pick talent from all over the world, and if there are sort of increased restrictions on you know, movement into the EU, they could obviously find it more difficult to do that. So I wonder if there is, you know, there might actually be scope for kind of resistance within football on that basis. You could maybe some form some sort of coalition of the willing there, but who knows really. I do think the sort of Fortress Europe project is likely to become a reality increasingly, unless of course, you know, things like what has recently happened in France continue to happen. And I have misgivings about that kind of popular frontism anyway. So we'll see, I guess.
I mean, my suspicion is that, you know, regarding football and immigration laws, you know, the big clubs will find ways to get the players that they want one way or another. As indeed has been the case in the UK, like post-Brexit, you know, bigger clubs are still able to sign players that you might not think would qualify for work permits under the change rules. And what you've really seen is like a real end to the sort of situation of the late 90s and 2000s, where like lower division clubs in England, such as Walsall, would you know, sort of dramatically improve their squads with players from around Europe. And now there are far, far fewer players from outside Great Britain and Ireland playing in the lower leagues of English football. But, you know, the top two divisions, I would say, relatively untouched by the consequences of Brexit.
Yeah, all that relatively, but that we're definitely seeing clubs turn increasingly to Africa and to other areas of the global south, and finding little loopholes in ways to sort of like outsource player development to other areas of the world in ways that are eerily reminiscent of you know, the colonialism of old, to be honest. I think it's really important now to say thank you, actually, first of all, to Navara for platforming what we think is a vital project, as well as one we get a huge amount of pleasure from. Specifically, we'd like to thank Charles Ravens, Navara's head of audio, for not only producing the podcast, but for commissioning it and for being kind and patient with us, as well as surpassingly capable and professional. But last but not least, we'd like to thank you, the listeners, especially those diligent friends of the show and the wider nascent acid football movement who have dutifully shared links on social media, and even in my mate Wayne's case, nagged his in-laws to listen. One of the things that I've always wanted to try to help cohere through this is a better network left within the subculture that is football fandom. So thank you to everybody who's playing their part in that. However, I think we as a left owe it to ourselves to try to build on that and actually carve out spaces for ourselves within football. For example, I was very pleased to see that Pelican House, which is a sort of hub for a load of lefty organisations, NGOs, trade unionists, and such, like where I used to work for two different organisations, actually, they opened up to show the game on Sunday. And my friend Andrew Jeffrey, who some listeners might know as a very self-effacing and self-sacrificing and kindly presence at The World Transformed, he and I were chatting about this the other day, and Andrew said, I'd like some different spaces to watch football in. And I think this is important because for all my sort of hippy-dippy stuff about coming together, I would quite like to be able to watch England games without the air of menace that seems to find its way into even pubs that don't generally have that. And if we want this experience to be for everyone, we need to further detoxify it so it's more welcoming. And I'd say the same about the England team, by the way. There's still not a single openly gay men's player. There's still not a single player of South Asian descent. And if the FA want the biggest possible talent pool, you know, even approaching it purely cynically, they've got a long way to go to correct that. I'm not saying, by the way, that lefties should silo themselves off and watch England games in little back rooms like a sort of Trotskyist sect or something. You know, my plan where I am for the World Cup in a couple of years' time is to coordinate all my local football comrades and basically commandeer a pub and make it more welcoming to marginalised groups just by sheer weight of numbers. I don't know. We could sort of bellow the Internationale over the top of God Save the King. What could possibly go wrong?
I mean, I've let listeners into a little secret. Whenever I'm in a situation where I kind of have to be singing the national anthem, like an England game, for example, I always sing Communism Will Win rather than...
Do you not just glower your way through it like Paul Scholes?
If I can, then I will. But, you know, sometimes needs must, Tom, needs must. All right. Well, look, I would like to just reiterate everything you've said there and also give my thanks to everyone at Navara Media who's made this series possible, including you, the listeners. And hopefully we will see you some other time, because there is always football and there is always more football. And thanks to the good people at UEFA and FIFA, there will always be more and more and more and more football. So, you know... who's to say whether we'll be part of that relentless growth? But either way, thanks a lot for listening, and take care, and enjoy the 2024-25 season.
Cheers, everyone. Up the Saints.